Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us very early on a very cold Friday morning for our panel on resurrecting the wall of fear, the human rights situation in Syria. I'm Steve Heidemann. I direct the Grants and Fellows Program at USIP and also work as a special advisor to the Institute's Muslim World Initiative. As most of you know, I'm sure, the last 3 months have seen a wave of crackdown, repression, arrests, intimidation, targeting opposition figures, public intellectuals, civil society activists in Syria. This crackdown began in early December following the first meeting of a new opposition coalition called the National Council of the Damascus Declaration. A large number of people were arrested. Some have been released, but as of today, 12 of the principal participants in that coalition remain under arrest.
13.
Thank you, Radwan. Including, notably, Riyad Saif, a former member of parliament, who is widely known to be in very poor health. On January 28th, a state security court charged those who continue to be held in prison with a wide range of very serious charges, including the charge of subverting the security of the Syrian state. These are charges that carry severe penalties in the event that the defendants are found guilty of the charges. Now, in one sense, this wave of arrests beginning December 10th or 11th and continuing through January can be seen as simply an upsurge or escalation of an ongoing wave of intimidation and repression that the Syrian government has directed against opposition figures going back as far as January of 2006. And yet, coming as it has in the wake of the Annapolis summit in November, remember the first arrests were in very early December, in the context of an ongoing political crisis in Lebanon, in fact, potentially a deepening political crisis in Lebanon, the U.S. today just announced, or yesterday announced, that it had dispatched a warship to sit off the coast of Lebanon as an indicator of the degree of concern that we feel about the stalemate in that country. In the context of ongoing concerns about Syria's role in Iraq, its relationship with Iran, its relationship with the United States, considering that the Syrians are about to host at the end of March an Arab League summit, the question of why the Syrian government is cracking down now, why the Syrian government is devoting so much attention to the repression of an opposition that I think has to be seen as both weak and vulnerable, raises a number of important questions about the motives of the regime. Is it acting out of a sense of vulnerability? Is this crackdown an expression of confidence and a reassertion of the regime's authority domestically? And it also raises questions about the policy implications of this crackdown, not only in the region, but also importantly for the relationship between Syria and the United States, where, even though the Bush administration has made quite clear its determination that it will not pursue a strategy of engagement with Syria, the question of engagement nonetheless remains very much on the table, in particular in the context of an active presidential campaign. To address these issues, we have with us this morning a panel that is, I think, uniquely equipped to talk about issues of human rights in Syria. Very pleased to be joined this morning by Mona Yacoubian. Mona is a senior advisor to the Institute's Muslim World Initiative. She co-directed with our colleague Scott Lisensky a working group on Syria that ran for 2 years and more or less wrapped up its activities at the end of last year. And Mona is currently directing a working group on Lebanon at the Institute. We also have Joe Stork, who is the Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa at Human Rights Watch and a longtime advocate of human rights in the Middle East. It was a particular pleasure of mine to serve with Joe on the Committee on Academic Freedom in the Middle East and North Africa of the Middle East Studies Association. And in particular, we're especially pleased to have with us Dr. Radwan Ziada. Radwan is a senior fellow of the JR Fellows Program here at the U.S. Institute of Peace this year. He arrived here from Damascus only in October, where he had been the founder and the director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. And we're very pleased to be able to benefit from the perspective of someone who is very much an insider in all of this process. What I would like to ask is that each of our panelists speak for about 10 minutes. We'd like to begin with Radwan, and we want to make sure that there is, following their presentations, ample time for interaction from the audience. So with that, Radwan.
Thank you, Steve, so much. When he became president in 2000, Bashar Assad spoke on his desire to modernize the state and to combat corruption. But the result was most of the pro-reform activists living now in the prison in very bad situation. On September 2000, Damascus Spring began. Intellectual, civic figures, and opposition leaders that called political reform in Syria and end of the state of emergency and retain the rule of law. On 16 October 2005, a wide coalition of political reform activists publicly issued the Damascus Declaration for Democratic and National Change, which called for establishing a democratic system that respects citizens' rights, freedom of speech, association, and ends the discrimination based on religion or political beliefs. And on May 2006, a petition was signed by more than 300 intellectuals and activists from Syria and Lebanon calling for the improvement of the relationship between Syria and Lebanon. But the result of all of these civil society movements was the detention and the torture in the prisons. Security is still used as a pretext to silence all forms of dissent. The state of emergency imposed from 1963 remains in force. And the political stability and national security, this concept of security contests justify daily controls and restrictions on civil society, freedoms of association, expression of assembly continue to be strictly limited. A number of media workers and correspondents, including bloggers, also faced arrest, harassment, while the regime continued to monopolize all forms of media and in the internet. On 9 December 2007, in reaction to a meeting organized by the Damascus Declaration for Democratic and National Change Initiative on the 1st of December 2007, which gathered a wide coalition of political reform activists calling for establishing a democratic system, the Syrian State Security Services began a series of arrests of more than 40 activists in various cities in Syria. These arrests are a direct violation of the right of freedom and expression and association. This meeting, which covered 163 persons in Damascus and results in the creation of the National Council of the Damascus Declaration, collective movement of opposition and pro-democracy groups in Syria, gathering political activists as well as human rights defenders. The arrest targeted all participants to the meeting, but those that had been elected to the council of the Damascus Declaration were kept in the prison. And later charged in 28th of January this year of breaching brevias of the Syrian Criminal Code. Some of these brevias provide for prison sentences for at least 7 years. All of them, they were all transferred to Adra Central Prison, and Mrs. Fida al-Hurani moved to Douma Women's Prison. Among of them, Ahmed Ta'ma, Jabir Ashoufi, Riyad Saif, and Akram al-Punni, Fida al-Hurani, Ali al-Abdallah, and others. Most of these prisoners had already had a previous experience in the prison, and they spent 5 to 10 years from their lives in it, in the prison. As example, Riyad Saif had spent 5 years in the jail as a political prisoner before his release in 2006. He was arrested at September 2001 during Damascus Spring Movement. He is suffering now from prostate cancer, and the Syrian authorities have banned him from traveling to seek treatment. Political activist Ali Abdallah has been jailed 3 times in the past 13 years. One of his sons is serving 5 years also, sentenced for his involvement in pro-democracy youth group. And other his son chose exile, having already spent 6 months in jail. Akram al-Wunni also had spent 18 years in jail as a political prisoner from 1985 until 2001. And Dr. Walid al-Bunni has spent 5 years in jail during Damascus Spring. Dr. Fida al-Hurani, she is the daughter of Akram al-Hurani. Akram al-Hurani is one of three members who established Ba'ath Party in Syria and in Iraq. And I just heard yesterday that her husband, the security service, forced her husband to leave Syria. They took him and put him on the Syrian-Jordanian border because he is Jordanian. And he is a physician, but he has residence in Syria filled at the end of this year. But they canceled the residence, and they took him to Jordan. According to the lawyers, they were tortured, and writer and activist Ali Abdallah was beaten so badly so that he now has a wall in his windpipe. Signs of the beatings were evident on the detained faces Mr. Abdallah, and they refused his request to see a physician. The situation of human rights in Syria was deteriorated over the past 3 years. The May 2006, as I said, the second wave of detention, Beirut-Damascus Declaration, which called for better relations between Syria and Lebanon, was followed the largest crackdown on civil society since the breaching of Damascus Declaration, the third wave of detention in 2001. In 2007, several human rights defenders were sentenced by the Damascus Criminal Court. Lawyer Anwar al-Bunni, the head of Damascus Center for Legal Studies and the president of the Committee for the Defense of Political Prisoners. Michelle Kilo, president of the Organization for the Defense of Freedom and Speech in Syria. And Mahmoud Issa, human rights activist. All of them arrested in mid-May 2006 by security and intelligence force after they have signed the Beirut-Damascus Declaration. And we still have, from the first wave of detention after Damascus of Damascus Spring Movement, Arif Dalila. Arif Dalila is a prominent academic and pro-democracy advocate, crackdown on the Damascus Spring, who continues to serve since 2001 a 10-year prison sentence for criticizing the government in the context of the Damascus Spring. In 2006, Arif Dalila suffered a severe stroke and was reportedly denied proper medical care by the prison authorities. And we have also Kamal Labwani, arrested in April 2005, upon his return from a trip abroad, during which he met the Arabian and the American officials, was convicted in May 2007 by the Damascus Criminal Court to 12 years. And we still, all the Human Rights Association have not been registered by the systemic refusal of the Ministry of the Social Affairs and Labor. And all of the human rights defenders and human rights activists now banned from traveling outside Syria, and the government prevent them to attend to regional and international workshops. This is briefly what the situation of the human rights defenders in Syria and activists. And I don't talk about the legal situation, about the law of election, the law of association, the law of organization. All of this law now, they need to change if we have a democratic system in Syria. But we can talk later in the during the question. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Steve and Mona, Radwan, and all of you for coming. I think this, the situation that Radwan just sketched out, I would just point out that, you know, the numbers of people that have been arrested in the recent crackdowns is one indication of the scope of the problem. Another is the severity of the sentences. Labwani was sentenced to 12 years in prison for the crime of basically meeting with government officials from here in Washington and in various European capitals and talking about human rights problems in Syria. Fedha Hurani is the first woman who's been arrested in quite a few years, I think. And we found out actually that just last night her husband, who's a Palestinian, was forcibly expelled from Syria to Jordan. So we're talking about a very ongoing situation, and a situation that's marked by a great deal of, I'd say, capricious cruelty on the part of the regime. And sort of as an illustration of that, I thought I'd speak just a couple of minutes about one case that Radwan mentioned, but hasn't figured in the latest arrest, just because, in fact, he's already been in jail since 2001, namely Professor Arif Dalila. Dalila's case, Professor Dalila's case, is one that Steve and I worked on together at the Academic Freedom Committee back at the time when he was arrested. He was arrested in September 2001 following a meeting in Riyad Saif's house. He was kept in solitary confinement for many months leading up to his trial at the State Security Court, where he was, as Radwan mentioned, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Now, what was Dalila, who's now about 65 years old, was 59 at the time of his arrest. He had been a participant in the National Dialogue Forum, which was one of the sort of manifestations of the so-called period of spring in the Damascus Spring. He was one of 10 people who were arrested at the time. He was a professor of economics, in fact, the dean of the economics faculty at Syrian University. This was not his first brush with the law or with the authorities. He had been forcibly removed as dean in 1998 because he tried to organize a conference to talk openly about Syrian economic problems. He was reinstated by President Bashar Assad in 2000 as a professor, not as a dean. But then, as I mentioned, in September 2001, he's been out of commission, forcibly removed from the scene. What was his crime? According to his lawyers, he was accused of, quote, organizing subversive gatherings, some gatherings that other people went to at Riyadh Saif's house that were open gatherings, quote, gatherings aimed at causing disorder, unquote, and, quote, forming a secret society. All of them totally preposterous charges. The fact that he was brought up before the State Security Court is an indication of, you know, the misuse by the Syrian government, like governments elsewhere in the world, of the whole national security rubric as a justification for putting people, critics that they don't like, including critics who are completely nonviolent, do not engage in or advocate political violence, just getting them out of the way. Just to give you a flavor of the sort of threat that Aras Dalila represented to the Syrian government, he had written an op-ed in Al Hayat, the London-based Pan-Arab newspaper, in March 2001, and this gives you a flavor of the sort of the trenchancy of his criticism, but also the character of the man. And I'm reading here from his op-ed. It will be useful to reiterate what I said in the amphitheater at Damascus University to the leadership of the front 20 years ago. And then he goes on to say, we live in a republic, we have a progressive constitution, we have progressive nationalist front together with a multitude of parties. We have a people's assembly, we have a cabinet, we have boards of directors that can't be rivaled, we have grassroots organizations inclusive of a variety of people. We have this, we have that. What then are we missing? Why have you invited us, speaking now to officials, why have you invited us to tell that the motherland is in danger? If what you are saying is true, and it is, then the shells and skeletons of these institutions are all dead, unrepresentative of the people. And the ending of this danger requires changing those institutions. What's taking place is the logical and inevitable result of your policies and practices. You've shelved the Constitution and the laws, replaced them with one law composed of one line, unwritten, invisible. This law dominates all aspects of our daily lives after all other laws have been rendered ineffective. It states, whoever proves his adequacy in corruption, sabotage, or subversion is advanced from the lowest post to the highest. He who proves his adequacy in science, work, nationalism, or loyalty is degraded to the lowest post or even some trout. And of course, that's exactly what happened to Aref Dalila. Now, I mention this case because, Aref Dalila has not figured, he's not been, to the extent that Syrian dissidents have any kind of a profile in the West, his is really quite low, precisely because he has been locked away since September 2001. His health is not good. He suffers from thrombosis and a heart condition. We understand that finally the authorities are allowing him to take some basic medications for that treatment, but all the appeals for his release just on humanitarian ground, never mind an effort to get him released because the charges against him are so preposterous, have so far been met with refusal on the part of the government. And I think Aref Dalila's case is kind of emblematic, for me at least, it's very emblematic of the character of the regime. I'm not sure it helps us ask the question Steve posed about why, frankly, but it certainly represents, it seems to me, a good encapsulation of the nature of the problem. So what can be done about it? I think this is a very relevant question, and it's a question that's very difficult to answer. Our organization, Human Rights Watch, has had a very difficult time monitoring developments in Syria. We have not been allowed into the country since 1995, so 13 years now. I think the reason we have not been allowed in is primarily because the series of reports that we did following that visit in 1995 were on the state security courts, on the problems that Kurds face, Kurdish Syrians face in getting recognized as citizens. Our documentation of some of the serious abuses and massacres, in fact, in some of Syria's secret prisons. These were the reasons we haven't been allowed in. And not just not allowed in to report on Syria. We, back in 2001, when we were trying to get into northern Iraq, while Saddam Hussein was still in Baghdad, and one of the only ways in was through Syria. We were not allowed in even to make that transit. Much more recently, just in the last few months, we wanted to get in to look at the situation of Iraqi refugees in Syria. And as most of you probably know, Syria's record in terms of hosting Iraqi refugees has been relatively good compared to the policies of neighboring countries. So while I'm sure we would have had some recommendations for the government coming out of such an investigation, it was not something that the government reasonably have thought be threatening, but simply not allowing us in. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean we physically can't go in the country, but it does mean that we can't do the kind of investigations, collecting testimonies and so forth from victims and witnesses. That is the core of our methodology. Not because we can't get in, but because of the risk that's posed to the people who might be our interlocutors there. Anyone who's and this goes for whether you're a Syrian or an Iraqi refugee or whoever, any resident, and particularly residents who are citizens and residents who have any kind of profile whatsoever. As activists, as civil society activists, as writers, as part of the intelligentsia, and so forth, you're immediately called down to the Mukhabarat to talk about that conversation you just had with this visitor from Human Rights Watch or from the New York Times or whoever. So that creates a situation where it makes the kind of reporting that we do very difficult. It doesn't stop us, but it means we're very much looking at this, having to look at the situation from the outside, and depending on indeed our Syrian colleagues getting information out to us by the internet and by other means. Now, in terms of the role of outside powers, I'm thinking here primarily of the member states of the European Union as well as Washington. Again, it's kind of difficult to know what to suggest, although it's clear that the policies of kind of disengagement, shall we say, or ostracism that have, at least in the case of Washington, have been sort of characterized relations over the last number of years, certainly don't help matters any, don't provide any venues for discussion. Now, in the case of the EU, that's less the case because they do have a diplomatic presence in Damascus. There have been on again, off again discussions between Damascus and Brussels about an association agreement and so forth. So there are some carrot elements in the mix in the case of the Europeans. But, frankly, to take the case of the United States and Europe, their relations are not good. Their visits between officials of the two countries are extremely rare. But when you have somebody like Nancy Pelosi going to Damascus, as she did last year, and not saying a thing in the meeting she had with officials, or in her public comments surrounding her trip, not saying a thing about the human rights situation. When you have Javier Solana representing the European Union going to Damascus and basically behaving in exactly the same way, what we can say is that there clearly are opportunities that are being missed. I think it's also the fact that the U.S. government, the White House in particular, has been responding to individual cases like Lavwani's and some of the other cases with statements read from the podium at the White House at the daily press briefing that, could have been written by us. I can assure you they weren't, but they could have been. I mean, they sort of talk about the right issues and so forth. But again, I'm not sure this is very helpful when you have when it's coming from a podium, the White House, which is extremely selective in what human rights abuses it finds worthy of speaking of from the podium, when there are other abuses going on very much of sort of worthy of the same kind of attention, whether it's in allied countries or countries allied to the U.S. like Egypt or Saudi Arabia and so or Jordan, not to mention the situation in the occupied territories. So, you know, this sort of, this not only, I think, is not too effective in terms of having any kind of impact or persuading Damascus to behave differently, but frankly, it also, because of its selectivity and the very transparent sort of nature of the double standards at work here, kind of makes the job of anyone working on human rights issues in Syria all that more more difficult. I think in terms of what, you know, we would be trying to do to keep on top of the situation, in addition to sort of reporting on cases that come to our attention and looking at issues. We put out a report a few months ago on the associations law, for instance, the problems that would-be NGOs have in Syria in terms of registering and having some kind of a, you know, legal standing. I think the other approach that is certainly worth pursuing is for elements of civil society in countries like the United States that are not limited to human rights organizations, but would include people like yourselves, people with the USIP, and so forth. Whether the USIP as an institution could take part in this, I don't know. But, you know, forming sort of coalitions that go to request meetings with the Syrian ambassador and so forth, conduct public activities that raise the profile of some of these individuals, like Kamal Labwani, like Fida Hurani, like Arif Dalila. I mean, frankly, it's you know, I'm not throwing out very much that's terribly. I don't know. I'm not being very helpful. I realize that it's difficult to. There's obviously no silver bullet here. So I'm being quite frank in letting you know sort of the kind of things that we're limited to discussing in terms of affecting from this country anyway, affecting the human rights situation in Syria. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mona.
Thanks, Steve. And thank you both, all three of you, actually, for joining us on the panel. What I'd like to do is maybe start with two analytic points and then talk briefly about what I think the implications are for U.S. policy. In terms of the analytic points, the first is I want to underscore, I think, how Syria's isolation, being ostracized from the international community, plays into the fact that I think it believes it can act with impunity when it comes to treatment of dissidents and human rights activists in its own country. Certainly, Syria is not in the headlines. I mean, what's going on in Syria is very much eclipsed by U.S. presidential elections, the situation in Iraq, Iran, Gaza, you name it. And I think that's evident in the fact that this story, as important as it is, has not really been covered very well, certainly in the U.S. or European press. And I really applaud the efforts of Human Rights Watch and others, both in the States and in Europe, for raising the case. I think it's essential to shine the spotlight, a big, bright spotlight, on what's going on in Syria. The second point is to this question of the motivations. And let me say that Syria is such an opaque country. I wouldn't pretend with any amount of accuracy or precision to have an understanding of the inner workings of the Syrian regime. So let me answer the question safely by saying I think they do this from both a sense of confidence and a sense of vulnerability. Confidence in the sense of what I've just said, that they believe no one's going to do anything, no one's paying attention, and they act with impunity. But that's a very, I would say, shallow confidence. I also believe that they are very much acting from a sense of vulnerability. Syria is an authoritarian regime. Authoritarian regimes, by their nature, are excessively paranoid. The Syrians are no exception. Beyond that, I think there are developments that one can point to that add to this sense of threat or vulnerability. Again, from the perception or the perspective of the Syrian regime, movement on the International Tribunal to try those connected with the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. The Syrians are strongly suspected of having played a role, perhaps a significant role, in that attack and a string of subsequent assassinations that have taken place in Lebanon of critics of Syria. So the extent to which that tribunal moves forward, I believe, adds to their sense of threat. Indeed, there are some who believe that the Syrians view this tribunal as an existential threat, and as perhaps from their perspective, a Trojan horse for regime change. So that's one issue. The second is the meeting that Radwan described. The fact that activists in Syria were able now not just to talk but to act, to get together, that these activists spanned a broad spectrum politically, that they reached down into the younger generations in Syria. Again, I'm not saying that they pose a threat to the regime, but I am saying that the very actions from the regime's perspective are threatening. A few days after that meeting, a story not covered here very well or hardly at all, but I think that received a great deal of attention in Syria, President Bush met with three Syrian dissidents in exile, people who are openly calling for the overthrow of the Syrian regime. I believe, again, the extent to which these meetings are held symbolically, I don't think they make much of a difference on the ground. I do think they add to this, again, this sense of threat, that they create a certain degree of static. The meeting coming so quickly after the one in Damascus may well have further spooked the Syrians. We also have just broader issues, turmoil in Lebanon, deepening turmoil, I think Steve very accurately characterized it. And the Syrian sense of vulnerability, such as it is, in that there are those who are opposed to Syria, opposed to Syrian hegemony in Lebanon, operating from Lebanon. And finally, I think just broader socioeconomic pressures. Rising inflation. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times the other day about the impact of rising oil and gas prices on countries in the region, and Syria was featured in that piece fairly prominently. Syria also does host 1.5 million Iraqi refugees, and this has clearly added, I think, an additional strain. So I think there's a broader sense of vulnerability with respect to restiveness from its own population. This does not excuse what the Syrians are doing. I'm just putting it out there as a means of trying to understand what the motivations are. So what are the implications for U.S. policy? Well, to date, our policy, as Steve has said, has largely been one of isolating the Syrian regime. There have been episodic periods of engagement, but they're very much based on particular narrowly defined issues, and typically that engagement is usually followed very quickly by some sort of negative response to the Syrian regime. Most recently, the Bush administration, this is just in this month, expanded existing sanctions, Treasury sanctions, to now include freezing the assets of Syrian government officials and their associates who are believed to be involved in public corruption. This is important in the sense that corruption is a huge issue in Syria, and it's one that resonates across the board. But I would say it comes late. It comes as part of broader criticism, again, of Syria's role or unhelpful role in Iraq. So I think in some ways the value of this gets lost. Our government has specifically designated Rami Makhlouf, who is President Bashar al-Assad's cousin. He is a well-known figure in Syria, very corrupt, very close, obviously, to the president. So there's a lot of symbolic value in designating him. I don't believe he has assets in the United States. So these are, again, I think the impact is symbolic. And I would say, ultimately, what happens with the sanctions is, one, they certainly can create an atmosphere of uncertainty. They can make it more difficult for people to do business in Syria or to contemplate doing business in Syria. But their impact on the ground to date, I would say, has been minimal. So essentially, as I see it, there are really two policy options, two ways to go. Right now, I think we're sort of in a muddled middle ground where we sort of have some sanctions that are symbolic in nature. We have withdrawn our ambassador, so we don't really have any deep diplomatic contact, certainly not on the ground. We have these periodic discussions with Syrians in exile, whose influence inside Syria, I think, is questionable. And in fact, I would put out there that it may well be that these meetings, in fact, further endanger those inside Syria. I have real questions as to how important or how useful it is for the President of the United States at a high level to have these meetings rather than perhaps working with people more quietly. So in any event, it's sort of this middle ground. Either we supercharge an isolationist policy in order for it to be effective. And here I'm talking about multilateral sanctions. You'd have to have not only the Europeans on board, but the Russians, the Turks, the Chinese, and you still have Iran out there. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that will work, and I don't think it's effective. Or you embark on a strategy of genuine engagement, where all of the issues are put on the table to include Syria's abysmal human rights record. And here I think people often look at Libya and say, can Libya be a model for following or pursuing a policy of engagement with Syria? And certainly the Libyans came forward with respect to renouncing terrorism, with respect for dismantling their WMD program. But the question of human rights and democracy in Syria was in Libya was left completely off the agenda. And it is indeed one of the most repressive governments in the region. So if we are to engage with the Syrians, we need to do it in a way in which we put all of the issues, including human rights and democracy, on the table. And we need to build some leverage and have some inroads and some means of engaging and connecting with them. And ideally, I hope, this is obviously a long-term endeavor, seeking to resolve the very abysmal human rights situation in Syria today. I'm going to unfortunately end on a very discouraging note to say that, even in a place like Egypt, where one would presume, given all the aid and so forth that we give the Egyptians, that we have tremendous leverage, we still have Ayman Nour languishing in prison along with many, many, many other prisoners. So this is a very, very difficult nut to crack. But I still leave it that I believe we need to engage rather than isolate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've had three, I think, very interesting perspectives on the Syrian human rights situation, taking into account both the details of what is happening on the ground, but also providing a broader sense of the context in which this crackdown of the past few months is playing out. We have a microphone on the side of the room, and anyone who would like to ask a question, I would invite to go to the microphone. While people are lining up, I thought I would return to this question of why now, which Mona began to elaborate on, and to add a few additional thoughts about the possibility, but possible explanations for why the regime has decided to pursue this course now. And it seems to me that there are four possible reasons we could take into account. And I'll sketch through them quickly because I see the line is growing. The first is that as the crisis in Lebanon has deepened, including the continuing threat of the Hariri assassination tribunal, I think the tolerance of the Syrian regime for any kind of alternative perspective about Syria's role in Lebanon has diminished to the extent that the Beirut Declaration served as a source of mobilization within Syria for those who imagine the possibility of an alternative framework for Syrian-Lebanese relations. It clearly needed to be shut down in that capacity. Second, growing disregard for external pressures. I think it's clear that in the period since 2005, but even prior to that, we've seen that external sanctions of the kind preferred by the United States and supported to some extent by France have largely failed to alter Syrian behavior. And so it seems to me this creates a perception among the Syrian leadership that there are lower international diplomatic costs associated with pursuing a course of domestic repression. Third, I would point to the retreat of the freedom agenda. I don't think there's any question that in the space, in the period between 2003 and 2005, it was perceived within Syria that there was more space in which domestic opponents could meet, could speak, could make their views known. It seems to me that this has diminished as the pressure of the administration on the Freedom Agenda, including the possibilities it held open for pursuing a muscular program of regime change directed at Damascus, as that's declined. Again, the sense that the downside for engaging in domestic depression or repression have diminished, and that I think the regional consequences for Syria of pursuing a course of domestic repression have also turned out to be relatively low. Investment continues to flow. Damascus was named as the capital of Arab culture for 2008. The summit will be held in Damascus on March 29th, even though attendance continues to be a question mark, particularly with respect to Saudi attendance. And so it seems to me that we're in an environment today in which the opportunity costs of repression are low, at precisely the moment in which the regime is operating on the basis of what I would view as a particularly exaggerated conception of the threat represented by this relatively weak domestic opposition. So when we think about the question of why now, it seems to me these four reasons need to be factored into the mix. And with that, Laura, please.
Thank you very much, Laura Schultz from the Department of State. Thank you to the panelists for framing these really important and critical issues in such a compelling way. I wanted to build on Joe's question about what can be done and ask for any of the panelists' thoughts on, first, the role of Arab civil society, whether there is a potentially supportive or helpful role that organizations in the region can play. And also, kind of outside of the usual circle of donors and foundations, are there effective, are there possible roles for universities or other institutions here in the United States to be supportive of the plight of the Syrian civil society activists? Thank you.
Okay, I can start on that, I guess. In terms of the role, the sort of Arab civil society, let me start with Syrian civil society. I won't make any claims to knowing the dynamics particularly well, but it seems like in Syria, like in many other parts of many other Arab countries, the NGO scene, even the human rights scene, is not marked by a great deal of collegiality and getting together on these issues. There's competition. There are rivalries. So clearly, this is a problem that is not helping matters. Not necessarily easy to address, but there is some responsibility, it seems to me, on the part of our colleagues in Syria and in other parts of the region to recognize this and attempt to deal with it constructively. It has been, to the extent that there are organizations in the Arab world based in the Arab world that take up these issues sort of on a regional basis, they certainly do take up the Syrian issue. So what more can they do? I mean, certainly they could do more. But again, we're talking about a region in which, with a few exceptions, the human rights community is on the, frankly, the small and beleaguered side. So, but they do, it's not like they kind of eschew taking up these issues. As for academics, I think it's a good point, and I know that one of the Henry Munson once saying, who teaches up in Maine, and he was talking about Morocco rather than Syria, but it was sort of in the, what the Moroccans call the years of lead in Morocco. And I remember getting up in a Mesa meeting and saying, he says, the State Department report on human rights in Morocco is a whole lot more candid, a whole lot more refreshing than anything any of us academics have ever written about the human rights situation in Morocco. And I suspect the same could be said of Syria. I mean, one of the, the fact of the matter is that, academics who know Syria best, are the ones who are able to go there. If you speak out, you don't go anymore. So, I mean, there's, you know, there are, there's kind of there's a structural problem here in terms of getting, I mean, I think MESA, the Middle East Studies Association, in my, to my knowledge, stands out among kind of the regional studies associations in actually having a committee, a very active committee, although Steve and I are no longer associated with it. At least I'm not. Are you associated
with it? I sure am.
Yeah, okay.
for my sins.
I'm not. But you know, does take up these issues as a body. I'm not sure to what extent the Syrian Studies Association does, and whether there's any avenue, you know, whether that represents a. But for reasons, for sort of structural reasons that I just mentioned, it would be, you know, there'd be a risk factor there. Just a few thoughts.
I think the most vibrant and courageous parts of Syrian civil society are now located largely in the United States and Europe. On the ground, it seems to me that civil society organizations, and I'm excluding from consideration the growing number of civil society organizations that are really extensions of the regime in one way or another. The wife of President Bashar herself is the sponsor of a network of some 7 civil rights organizations, everything from Shabab, a youth group, to Mawrid, a women's economic empowerment organization, to Firdus, which works on rural development. All of these continue to be active. They have absolutely no political agenda whatsoever. But among those groups that do pay attention to improving the quality of political life in Syria, I would say the 4 adjectives that best characterize them are weak, hemmed in, inward-looking, and fragmented. And what was so potentially interesting about the creation of this Declaration Council in December is that it represented perhaps the first attempt to move beyond this framework of largely insular, isolated, fragmented civil society organizations to create something more effective. And we see how the regime responded.
Let me add something that, except Libya and Tunisia and Syria, there is a movement in the other Arab civil society countries. Let's go to the numbers, even that it's not important. In Morocco now we have 25,000 NGOs, then Egypt, 17,000. I think we have a large number of organization working on human rights, women's rights, the rule of law. But we have phenomenon in civil society in Arab world called GUNGOs, governmental, non-governmental organization. As Steve said, that we have some NGOs controlled by the security or the government, and they working in the human rights situation or women's right to get funds from outside, then they haven't anything. And we have large number of reports about corruption on this kind of organizations. And I believe that, but we still have some have of progress in civil society movement. Next month we have a meeting in Morocco to address how can we establish the Arabic movement for human rights. And I think in Morocco and Egypt we have a strong human rights organization. Maybe these 2 countries can lead the movement to progress.
Melissa Maley with CNO Resources. First of all, I want to thank the panel for a very interesting and informative presentation. So often here in Washington, when we talk about Syria, we talk about Syria in a regional context, because there is a lot to talk about in terms of what Syria is doing that's undermining U.S. policy. However, this panel today talked about what Syria was doing to Syrians. And I think that's very useful because that's not something that gets a lot of attention here by policymakers. And in that context, Mona, you talked about engagement, which is certainly always, you know, the running debate here in Washington, engagement or non-engagement. frankly, I think it's a false argument. It should be what type of engagement, because we are engaged. We sent, Steve said, we sent a battleship to the Mediterranean today, and that is a form of engagement. But I would like to ask Radwan very specifically, having just come from inside, having waged the activist battle of within civil society, operating with a wide variety of human rights and democracy activists, how do you view what the U.S. is doing? When the U.S. invites Syria to Annapolis, and then there's a crackdown that following week, and or when Pelosi comes and visits, and then there's a crackdown the following week against activists. I mean, how is that the overall story that you see, or do you see this as a continuum of kind of the tit-for-tat of engagement in with their forward movement? I mean, could you frame that for us and tell us whether you know, what you want to be seeing more or less of?
I believe that depends on the image of the U.S. inside Syria and inside Arab countries. When the Syrians or the Arab audience heard about watched the photos in Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo and others, and that's not helped the human rights fight in Syria when U.S. talking about the human rights. Two things. I believe that the human rights fight is intermediate fight. Should be dealing with them as human beings. Should be any regime or put it in the first priority of the U.S. policy or EU policy. But when U.S. criticized Syria about human rights file and didn't touch Saudi Arabia files in human rights or in Egypt files, that didn't make the credibility of the U.S. criticism in Arab countries or in Syria. I think as George said about double standards, I believe that if we can make the human rights file away from other files of Syrian foreign policy in Lebanon or Syrian foreign policy in Iraq or other countries, and we focusing more about this issue as a basic human rights, I think we'll have success.
Mordechai Zhuezhati from the National Defense University. I too want to thank the U.S. Institute of Peace for shedding light on this very, very important issue. Joe Stork and Radwan Ziadeh did a terrific job in describing the human rights abuses in Syria. Now, given the ferociousness of the regime on that issue, my question is, how can we account for the fragmentation of the opposition? Not the weakness, but the fragmentation of it. How can it be fragmented in the face of such prolonged human rights abuses? Thank you.
Well, I think, I think one reason for the what you call the ferociousness of the government's response is precisely to intimidate. It's not only to punish the people who do speak out, the people who do try to organize. It's to intimidate others from doing so. It poses, you're talking about a situation in which, I mean, you know better than I, individuals are at grave risk for their own, perhaps not for whether they live or die, but in terms of whether they're free or not free, whether they can support their families or not. I mean, it has enormous consequences. So in any kind of situation like that, I don't think fragmentation is such a surprising reaction.
Forgive me. Here again, I'm not talking about weakness. We understand the deterrent power of coercion, the coercion of the state. But within the opposition itself, there's a lot of ideological fragmentation. There is a lot, apparently, of little petty games played between and among leaders of this Damascus Declaration, which has prevented it from being united in the face of the state. So I do understand intimidation, but it's the fragmentation I'm talking about.
when we talk about the weakness of the Damascus or the Damascus, the opposition in Syria, I think this is a natural result of the any authoritarian regime. We cannot hear about opposition in Cuba or in Libya. This is very natural result about this kind of these regimes. But I still believe that the opposition in Syria or the coalition of the Damascus Declaration, they have some changes in their discourse, on their speech. When they put the democracy in the first priority, if the Brotherhood talking about they didn't mention about the Islamic State, they talking about the civil state, and the communist parties. The communist party, they changed the name of their parties from communist party to assembly party. This is good signs. How can the democracy concept as a first concept or the priority concept of inside the Damascus Declaration, and when we have diversity inside the Damascus Declaration, that's really a good sign. We don't need to make the Damascus Declaration like Ba'ath Party one block, without any views, without any different viewpoints. This is, I think, it's healthy sign for the opposition that have different perspectives, and they believing that human rights and democracy the only way to change the situation in Syria.
Could I just jump in on this one?
I also wanted to, Maura. Let me do so after you.
Okay. I think, as you know, Maura, you know better than. Certainly than most of us. I mean, Syria is a country of tremendous diversity. So you are going to have ideological differences. There's this strong Islamist tradition borne out by the Muslim Brotherhood. There's the secular sort of / communist tradition. There's a Kurdish population that has its issues. So I don't find the ideological differences to be surprising. I think what's interesting and what appears to happen, and I'd like to hear maybe Radwan speak a little bit more on this, is this meeting in December appeared to be going a long way toward bridging those differences, most importantly by bringing in younger generations to also take an active role in the opposition. And, of course, the response by the Syrian regime says it all. I mean, as soon as one starts to get traction and bridge these ideological divides and sort of decide to put some of these differences aside in the name of forwarding an agenda of democratic reform, the crackdown intensifies.
All of that, I think, is very well taken. It does seem to me, though, that as observers and to some extent supporters of civil society and human rights movements in Syria, we also have to acknowledge, however, that there is something of a darker side to the internal dynamics of civil society organizations in Syria, and that it's very difficult for them, as it is for their counterparts in other countries, to escape some of the broader pathologies that shape the dynamics of organizational life in an authoritarian context. Civil society organizations tend to be anchored very heavily in a single charismatic individual leader. They tend to exhibit relatively low levels, it varies, but relatively low levels of internal democracy in terms of their own practices and operations. And they tend to be vulnerable to the kind of efforts on the part of regimes to fragment, divide, and keep them from forming the kind of larger coalitions that might enhance their effectiveness. So there is an extent in a sense in which the norms and practices of political life in these authoritarian settings more broadly diffuse outward into the civil society organizations that are struggling against these regimes. It's one of the reasons why I think some of the efforts aimed at strengthening the leadership capacity of civil society groups at promoting internal democracy in the governance of civil society organizations within the Arab world and so on are some of the most important initiatives that U.S. democracy promotion organizations and the MEPI program and others working on civil society development in the Arab world have contributed to, because I think these also hold important potential for equipping civil society organizations to act more effectively in pursuit of their agendas.
So. I'm Abe Solomon, in Arabic Ibrahim Sleiman. I was wondering if you can comment what would happen in Syria if the Syrian government gave the freedom you're seeking to the people at once. What will happen to the government? What will happen to the Ba'ath Party? And what will happen for the people? Wouldn't that take us back to the late 70s?
Thank you, Mr. Salam.
I think Syria, as you know well, that has a great history in democracy and Wilerism during the 50s and 60s. We have Syria was the first country has the independent constitution. We have the free press during the 50s. We have more than 274 magazines and free newspapers, and we have wide range of political parties. We have Ba'ath Party, Brotherhood, and Liberal parties, national parties. They fighting each other inside the parliament, and the democratic process was very 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 active during the 40s and 50s. What's happening after that? I think that's a question. But we still have the rich history of democratic experience. We can test it again.
Well, I think Syria had democracy for 5 years under Sheikh al-Qawwatli. After Sheikh al-Qawwatli went and Hosni Zaim took over, there was no democracy since.
Well. Yeah. But Hosni Zaim is still in the power just 137 days. Then there is another cup and another cup. But after 1854, when Shukr al-Qawwatli
1954
when Shukr al-Qawwatli again became the president, and Hashim al-Atassi and others. And I think that the democracy experience is stopped in 1958 when the Syria has a union with Egypt. But still, we need to go back to this period and to raise the question that Syria can go back to rich history and to benefit from this history to rebuild the future. Let's go now. What's the discussion inside Syria now? We have economic problems. We have social problems. We don't discuss about the future. How can the Syrian impact in the relationship between Syria and Arab countries? I think we have a huge number of problems. Depends about that, how the decision making in Syria now.
You did not answer my question. What will happen now in Syria if Syria, now, right now, if Bashar comes, say, he went back to when he gave the freedom, when he took power, what will happen now?
It seems to me that you're asking in part about whether loosening some of the restrictions on political participation might move Syria in one of two undesirable directions, whether it would unleash the kind of intercommunal or intersectarian conflict that has been evident elsewhere on the one hand, or whether it would lead to a rapid ascendance of Islamist factions, movements, to a position of political control. And I think we should be candid about what it is you... Right. And so... Well, I'm sorry?
I would like to hear an answer.
Well, frankly, we don't know, of course. But that certainly is not a good reason to maintain the status quo, it seems to me. It's the question that's posed in every single case of severe authoritarianism. You know, it's the same question that the Saudis, the proponents of continued royal family monopoly in Saudi Arabia, raise. It's the same question that Hosni Mubarak poses time and time again. It's not really a legitimate question, in my view.
Well, if I could just one little small point, and in maintaining precisely this kind of repressive apparatus, you may well be deepening the conditions to end up precisely where you're saying you don't want to end up. So, there's much to be said for gradual opening. That's the entire premise of the freedom agenda and the reasons for it.
I think that's right. I think the question is whether we need to pose the choice as one between the collapse and disappearance, in effect, of the current regime that does exhibit an evident capacity to manage and contain the internal pressures within Syrian society, and the disappearance of that on the one hand, and the failure to construct any kind of viable framework of governance in its place. I'm not sure we need to pose the choice in those terms. It is always the case that there are alternatives that are worse than the status quo, but I'm not entirely sure that we need to imagine that those are the only choices facing us.
Hello, my name is Greg Aftandili, and I'm foreign policy advisor to Congressman Chris Van Hollen. My question is for Mona, or maybe for you, Steve, as well. Over the past several years, the Bush administration is giving mixed signals about Syria's role vis-a-vis Iraq, in other words, allowing or not allowing foreign extremists or terrorists to transit the country to go to Iraq. And I'm curious how these mixed messages are being interpreted in Syria, because there are times when they say Syria is being cooperative, the other times say Syria is not being cooperative. I'm just curious how that affects the internal dynamic in terms of the decision-making on internal repression or things like that. Thank you.
I'll take a quick
As a constituent of Chris Van Hollen, I suppose, it seems to me that the Syrian reaction to concerns expressed by the United States about the role it's playing in controlling movement of people across the border into Iraq is that it has taken steps to try and manage and reduce the amount of traffic, that it's limited in its capacity to monitor with complete effectiveness what happens in that regard, and that it has seen very little benefit from the United States in terms of a shift in the tone emanating from Washington when it does seem to take steps to respond to American concerns in that area. It does seem that in the last several months, from news reports, that a more systematic effort is being made to try and control traffic of insurgents across the border into Iraq. And that has, in fact, yet to produce any meaningful shift in how the U.S. characterizes Syria's effort in that regard. And this has been one of the ongoing frustrations from the perspective of the regime in Damascus, that even when it has been responsive to requests from the United States for support in one way or another, it doesn't seem to create any kind of positive reaction or any kind of shift in tone on this side.
If I could just add to that, not only are the contradictory signals are being sent simultaneously by two different parts of the U.S. government. You have General Petraeus in Iraq, who has on more than one occasion talked in positive terms about Syrian efforts to control the flow of insurgents. And yet in this most recent, in February, this most recent expansion of sanctions, Syria's unhelpful behavior vis-a-vis insurgents into Iraq was very specifically mentioned. Now the discussion is about the need to impose greater visa restrictions on those transiting through from other Arab countries. My sense is that the Syrians, I would fully agree with what Steve has said, and essentially we undermine our efforts at engagement, the way the Syrians view it and the way they certainly portray it, is we continue to move the goalposts. And therefore, the sort of faith and trust that is essential in any sort of diplomatic engagement isn't there.
Hi, thank you for your panel. My name is Mahsa Maliki. I am Amnesty USA's country specialist for Syria. My question is, what hope? I want to know what change is possible, because I'm a volunteer activist. I mean, if I believe no change is possible, I should just give you my letter of resignation today. In particular, I want to know what sort of individual activism you think would be powerful, like it would be effective from the U.S. in particular, because I also feel some of the restraints that we can, in terms of affecting change in Syria. So
thank you. I think that's for Joe and Radwan.
Yeah, I believe that we will still believe in hope, even that the Syrian government arrested the leaders of the opposition and the well-known human rights defender. We still have the movement of human rights on the ground. We still have some statements coming from human rights organization, coming from very courage, grave human rights defenders, from inside and outside. I think that if we can get some, as Mona said, can international media or the international organization can help us to focus more about the situation of human rights in Syria. If you go back to the U.S. press or the Arabian press, you cannot find more articles or more news about what's going on in Syria. Even as I believe that the third wave of detention in Syria, that largest crackdown, we haven't in. This is the first time the Syrian government arrested a woman like Fida Horani, and they forced her husband to leave Syria. And I think that the first time that Syrian government arrested the leader of all the leaders of the opposition. And we have tortured them. This is the first time. They have a very bad situation, and we need more focused on the media, on the international organization, about what's going on in Syria.
I don't have too much to add to what Radwan said or the comment I made at the end of my presentation. I mean, I think in some ways, because of our lack of access to the country, because of the clampdown by the Syrian authorities in terms of information coming out of the country about the situation there, this is a period where we probably should be thinking much more seriously about campaigns around, you know, specific individuals, many of whose names have been mentioned here today, and by thinking creatively about other sectors of American and European and Arab society to engage on these issues.
And I would like to say, though, I hope not at the cost of embarrassing him, that Radwan himself is one of those courageous people who has continued to advocate on behalf of human rights. He did so while in Damascus under extraordinary pressure, and has continued to do so during his tenure as a senior fellow here at USIP. Radwan and I first met in the Havana Cafe in Damascus. Havana was Radwan's office. It's the place where he conducted business, and it seemed to him an especially appropriate venue for doing so because it's also the cafe where, as some of you might know, the founders of the Ba'ath Party met to draft the frameworks that became the foundational documents of the Ba'ath Party. And so for an activist...
So it's a safe house.
For an activist to use the Havana Cafe as a meeting place carried a particularly pointed irony. During one of our meetings there, we sat down, and within a few minutes, four rather gruff-looking gentleman from the Mukhabarat pulled up at the table behind us, where they paid a great deal of attention to our conversation, followed us out of the restaurant and walked with us as we made our way down the street. When Radwan and I split up, not surprisingly, they did not follow me, but they continued to follow Radwan. And we were joined that day by one of the people who was arrested recently and who is now in prison. And just that one experience was a very vivid indicator of the kind of extraordinary surveillance, intimidation, and pressure that people like Radwan operate under every day during their work in Damascus. And so if there is a reason for hope, it is, I think, that people like Radwan continue to act on their deep commitment to human rights and to improvements in the human rights situation in Syria.
Thanks.
My name is Amal Mudallili. I'm foreign policy advisor to Mr. Saad Hariri. My question is to what Muna was talking about, which you talked about the two options that you have. You have now the isolation or the engagement. And you said that you prefer the engagement. If we need to have engagement, we should put everything on the table, including human rights. I wish we can add to our language also that Lebanon, it will not be on the expense of Lebanon, that Lebanon will not be on the table as a bargaining chip for any deal with Syria or on anything that has to do with the Beni situation, because the Beni have paid in blood for the last 3 years to have their independence. And I think now they have a sensitivity when you say engagement. It comes to their mind that engagement is going to be the expense of Lebanon. So I wish we can just add, not on the expense of Lebanon. Thank you.
Because we have only a short time.
Can I just say one thing for the rest? Given, I mean, thank you very much for the question. It's very important. And by saying on the table, by no means should that mean a chip to be bargained, something to be traded. All of the issues, including Lebanon, perhaps in a very important way, need to be discussed. And in no way should Lebanon or its sovereignty be compromised or traded away in the name of engaging with the Syrian government.
Good morning. My name is Munif Atassi. I'm a Syrian-American. Thanks for the panel, and thanks for USIP. I have a huge investment in USIP. My daughter works here. I'm still paying her student loan. I would like to ask a quick question, the panel, if there's any comparative studies of the current human rights in Syria compared to the previous, the father regime in Syria, and if there is any relationship between that and the current regime and the isolation of Syria, are they, parametrically speaking, how do they compare? Thank you.
I'm certainly not aware of any study of that sort. I mean, look, there were things that went on under Hafez al-Assad that we haven't seen happening of late. I mean, I might mention the slaughter in Hama, for instance, in 1982, some of the killings mass killings of prisoners in Tadmor and other prisons. As far as we know, and I think we would know if those kinds of things were happening in the prisons, for instance. But I don't think we should take much hope from that. I mean, that may simply reflect the what's happened, shifts in Syrian society, the nature of political opposition and so forth, or for that matter, the threats posed to the government by alternative sources of power that perhaps don't exist anymore. So I don't put that forward as suggesting that the situation is better. I don't think it is. But there are certain kinds of crimes that were going on under the father that have not been going on under the son. Just for the record.
I think that when Hafez al-Assad died in June 2000, Riyad al-Turk, who is the general secretary of the Communist Party in Syria, who was sentenced in the jail in very bad situation for 18 years, he wrote a very good article about the end of the kingdom of the silence. He said that we lived for 30 years in the kingdom of silence. Now we hope that we can talk, we can meet together, and we can every Syrian believes that we have different future of what we have. I think that, as Joe said, this is the international environment is very different than when Hafez al-Assad became in power. And the human rights organization, especially the international human rights movement, now became more stronger. And the human rights as a society in Syria have a good connection with human rights. Because that, I believe that I hope and I wish that we cannot make the same history in the Syria which we have during Hafez al-Assad.
Well, with that, let me thank Radwan, Mona, Joe, and all of you for joining us for what I hope has been an informative and useful panel this morning. Thank you all very much.